Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. My guest today is Michael Schumann, a leading expert in building resilient communities. We'll bring Michael on in a moment, but first I just want to say a word about what happened in Boston on Monday. I'm a native Bostonian, born and raised in Boston, and I was at the Boston Marathon this Monday cheering on the runners. And it was an amazing experience to have so many hundreds of thousands of people cheering on perfect strangers who were running. And whoever it was running got the encouragement or cups of water from people on the sidelines. As I went downtown, the bombs exploded at the finish line. And when I came out at the Charles Street station, I heard sirens wailing all around and a helicopter whirring above, with streams of people coming down Charles Street, everyone talking on their cell phone or texting and being very animated. And I was wondering what was going on. Clearly something was wrong. As time went on, the horror became more clear. There were three dead, including an 8-year-old boy from my old neighborhood. And what we originally thought was 23 wounded grew to 140 people, some of whom have lost their legs, which is an ironic cruelty given those who came dedicated to running. So we know the horror there of the evil, whoever planted the bombs at the Boston Marathon finish line. Yet I'm here to tell you another side of the story, which is the people who ran towards those injured in the blast, not knowing if they had more bombs nearby, risking their lives to help strangers. It's the story of men who ripped the shirts off their back and used them as tourniquets to help stop the bleeding. It's the people who carried the wounded to get medical care. It's the staff in the medical tents who came prepared to help runners with dehydration and instead found themselves helping people with severe bleeding and loss of limbs. It is in the doctor who ran the marathon and then went to the operating room to help the wounded. It is in the runner who finished the 26.2 miles and then ran another mile to the hospital to donate blood. It is in the spectators seeing runners turn back from the finish line, shivering as their bodies cooled and giving their coats to keep warm. It is in the generosity of people who welcome strangers into their home to give them shelter and comfort. It is in this caring for one another that there is testament to the fact that love triumphs over evil. We can choose to focus on the horror, the cruelty of some demented person or group trying to slaughter innocents. Or we can focus on the thousand acts of kindness that people showed each other, love in action. Boston stands strong today, a resilient community coming from love, helping all who were involved. And now, as we have with us, Michael Schumann, who has dedicated his life to helping building resilient communities and economies. Michael Schumann is the Director of Research and Economic Development at the Business Alliance for Local Economies and a fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute. He has led community-based economic development efforts across the country and has authored or edited 7 books, including The Small Mart Revolution, How Local Businesses Are Beating the Global Competition, also Going Local, Creating Self-Reliant Communities in the Global Age, and another book, Local Dollars, Local Sense, How to Shift Your Money from Wall Street to Main Street and Achieve Real Prosperity. Michael Schumann, welcome to All Together Now.
Very nice to be with you, Eleanor.
Great to be with you. And I would appreciate it, Michael, if you could describe for our listeners, you know, just kind of the basic nature of your work.
Right. Well, if I could riff for a second off of your very beautiful opening, I would say that while many people who deal with issues around local economy building either are accused of or practice NIMBY, not in my backyard in one way or another. I have spent my lifetime practicing BIMBY, which is begin in my backyard. And I think that, you know, what you described in Boston is very much the philosophy of what people were able to bring to that otherwise horrible situation earlier in the week. And I feel like what I've been trying to do is help communities figure out the right steps in business building and politics and public policy that can render communities more self-reliant and more prosperous through that self-reliance. The books that I've done sort of lay out an alternative economic development strategy, and the most recent book, Local Dollars, Local Sense, is really all about identifying tools that people can use to invest in their communities. Because if I had to identify the single biggest mistake that public policy has made for the last 80 years, it's that we set in motion a securities law framework in the United States that has resulted in nearly all of our long-term capital going into the less than half of the economy that is represented by the Fortune 500 companies. And we have fundamentally neglected, we're not investing at all in local small business. And fixing that capital market failure is key to leading to resilient communities.
Fantastic. I salute you for doing some of the most important work happening in the world. So thank you for using your brilliance and your hard work to help make our communities more resilient and prosperous. I want to pick up on kind of where you ended there, that we've got basically the way things are set up now, that long-term capital tends to go to the Fortune 500 and not investing in the small businesses and the local businesses, where actually there's quite a number of people employed. So a lot of people are under the impression that it's really the Fortune 500 and the big businesses where most people are employed. Can you tell us, if you're looking at kind of where the jobs are and where the job growth is in the U.S. right now, how much of that comes out of the Fortune 500 and how much comes from the local small businesses?
Yeah, and it's an interesting question because we still don't know all the answers to it. Superficially, what you can say looking at the breakdown of jobs by business size is that about half the economy is in large business, which is defined as 500 jobs or more, and half the economy is in smaller or medium-sized businesses. But where it gets more complicated than that is that this is jobs. It does not count farmers or self-employed individuals, home-based businesses. And we know that those businesses have expanded quite dramatically. Some have even argued that it could be as much as a fifth of the economy. So all of those jobs really are part of the small business economy. And so if you add those into the first data points that I gave, then it's probably more like 60-plus percent of the economy that is small and local. And let me also just add that there are many pieces of the economy that are sort of out of the money economy, like parents who stay at home to raise children or family members who stay at home to take care of an elderly loved one. And if we accounted for those things at any level, what you would find is something like 80 or 90% of the economy is really in these local businesses or local activities. And that's why, at the end of the day, it's ludicrous to believe that if you invest in the tiny percentage of the economy that is the non-local, publicly traded global companies, why that would somehow magically lift the rest of your economy. It is the least important part of most local economies.
That's fascinating. So I appreciate you kind of clarifying that. So at least half of the jobs come from the smaller, mid-sized companies, not from big corporations with 500 or more employees. You know, we saw in 2008 this whole thing about the giant financial institutions and how they, you know, they fell apart. And their big risk-taking and their billions of dollars and trying to chase the toxic mortgages and all the rest of the shenanigans they were involved in, those big financial institutions could not survive without massive infusion of public taxpayers' money. And it's interesting to me to note that at that moment, literally hundreds of billions of dollars was being funneled in to these giant financial institutions, which account for about half the jobs, and yet the small and mid-sized businesses and the local communities were cut out of that and struggling. And it's amazing to me that in spite of the massive financial propping up by the federal government with our taxpayer dollars, that in spite of that, the small and mid-sized businesses are still have as many or more jobs as big business.
And it's even more, I think, daunting than that, because prior to 2008, you know, if you look at, say, the period, well, if we just pick, say, 1990 to 2010, it is true that there was a slight shift of about 2% of jobs from smaller business to larger business. But that happened in an environment where almost all of the key subsidies that the government gives were to larger businesses, whether it is in the form of economic development, attraction and retention payouts, which nearly all go to non-local businesses. It could be in the form of the kind of sales tax inequities that drive people to buy from Amazon and hurt local bookstores. It could be in the form of antitrust laws, which haven't been enforced, and that gives an advantage to bigger companies. It could be in the form of big subsidies that are paid to big water, big oil, big energy, big electricity, big cattle, all of these things that really disadvantage local businesses. If we had gotten public policy half right over the last 20 years, that kind of slight gain by larger businesses never would have happened.
Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, we all know how influential the big business can be in terms of getting government to bend regulations or even get subsidies out of it. I mean, it's shocking to me that the oil industry, ExxonMobil, one of the wealthiest corporations ever in the history of humanity, actually gets paid subsidies by the taxpayers to the tune of, you know, billions and billions of dollars every year. So in the face of that kind of a skewed playing field, how is it that we can support and nourish these small and mid-sized businesses?
Well, I think that there's sort of two or three important starting places. And, I mean, let's first just talk about at the local level what can be done, because I think those are the most accessible things available for people. So the first thing is that nearly every community in the United States has some kind of economic development program, and the vast, vast majority of them are pouring most of their money into policies that fall in the category of attraction or retention of business. And that is the phrase that one hears over and over again in economic development, attract and retain. What's odd about that formulation is that you cannot attract a local business. It's an oxymoron. And if the only way you hold on to a local business and induce it not to move is to pay it some kind of bribe, then its roots in the community really are not that deep to begin with. So we have to fundamentally retool economic development and just abandon altogether these kinds of attraction policies, and instead to focus economic development on nurturing entrepreneurship, building networks of local businesses that are more competitive as a group than they would be one business at a time. We need to encourage people to buy local. That supports the local business community. We need to encourage people to invest local because that gives those businesses the key capital that they need. And we need to look at other places in local public policy that might be tilting against small businesses. Like a typical example would be where home-based businesses face a monstrous number of regulations, restrictions. You can't hire people and put them in your house. You can't have people park in front of your house in order to come into your house and do business. So we really have to rethink a lot of our relationship to businesses to equalize the playing field. That would be a really big first step, just changing the nature of economic development.
Go ahead.
Well, Leah, let's just pause on that one and talk a little bit about that one, and then I'll mention the other two a little
Good.
Bit later.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I would just say that these things are being done around the country by groups. One of the groups that I've been working with since its inception, BALI, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, which has about 80 networks around the United States. There is the American Independent Business Alliance, which also has about 50, 60 networks across the United States. And then we have things like the Economic Gardening Movement. And all of these groups are building a kind of a practice and a theory of economic development that is rooted in nurturing local small businesses.
Fantastic. That's very exciting.
And it really has, I think, made a huge difference. I mean, it's interesting that 2010, in the summer issue of the Harvard Business Review, there was an article that said, titled something like "More small businesses means more jobs," and what it was is a regression analysis of about 200 metro areas in the United States, and what they found is that the fastest per capita job growth was in communities with a high density of local small business. And then another study in a journal called Economic Development Quarterly, which has never been sympathetic toward local small business, published a study that showed that per capita income growth, that is, growth of social equality, was also associated with the presence of local small business.
Yes, I think it's kind of well proven now that communities are more resilient with stronger local businesses there. And I think the fact that the small and mid-sized businesses are surviving and thriving and even having some job growth in the face of this economy is testimony to how solid they are, given how tilted the playing field is against them. But, you know, a lot of people think they can help out with this Move Your Money campaign, you know, getting our deposits and savings accounts out of the big banks like Bank of America and moving them into local, smaller regional banks or credit unions. What do you think of the Move Your Money campaign?
Well, I think it's a very important initiative, and I'll just give you one factoid that I think helps to characterize why it's important, and that is, if you look at all of the assets of either small or medium-scale banks, they represent about 20% of all the assets in banking. So 80% are in big banks, like Bank of America. That 20% assets is responsible for more than half of all small business lending in the United States.
Wow,
and
that's
dramatic.
And it
just shows how likely it is that any given money you put on deposit in one bank versus another will be that it actually goes into local small business. So I think that the Move Your Money campaign, which apparently something like close to 2 million people have done, is very important. Now, the bad news is that if you compare banking assets, which is sort of, you know, short-term deposits. I mean, we put our money in there, usually not for a very long period of time, but into checking or, you know, savings accounts. But the long-term stuff is stuff we save for our retirement or for our kids' college, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, pension funds, and insurance funds. And the size of all of that capital is about four times greater than all the money we put in banks. So what that means is that if the Move Your Money campaign were 100% successful, it still would barely put a dent in how capital moves in our country. And that's why it's so important to develop new ways for people to move their pension funds into local small business.
Wow. Is there a way that people can get involved in having the pension funds moved? Or that's, you know, it's, most people feel that's kind of out of their reach.
Yes. And that is the prevailing wisdom. And one of the things that I try to do in local dollars, local cents, is lay out for people things that are happening that are gradually laying a kind of alternative financial ecosystem, if you will, that will facilitate this. And I mean, let's sort of lay out what some of the components of that ecosystem would be. Mm-hmm. So we need to make it easier and cheaper for small businesses to issue what are called securities, basically, you know, either little tokens of ownership that people have in the company in the form of stock or debt notes that you might have from the company. But we have to make it, right now it's exceedingly expensive for small businesses to get even small amounts of money from most investors because of legal requirements. The second thing we need to do is we have to create local stock markets so that people can buy and sell their little securities that they have in these companies. The third thing is we have to create pools of money so that people can diversify, because it's always risky if you invest in any one business, even if it's a local business you love. And so we want to create local investment pools. But again, it's exceedingly difficult under securities laws to do this right now. And then the next stage is, you know, there are specific structures of investment pools called mutual funds, which, you know, most of us relate to with our long-term savings. And we have 7,500 mutual funds in the United States, but not a single one invests a penny in local small business. Not because it's illegal, but no one has been interested in doing so up to now. So that's another thing to change. And then the last piece is pension funds, you know, of big groups of employees, where someone who runs the fund has a sort of fiduciary responsibility to make sure that the money goes to the right place, and you know, we'll shop around, and you know, until there is all of the things that I just mentioned, you're not going to really find funds or mutual funds involved in local business that you can invest in. So I kind of went through all of that to make the point that you have to get to each thing through the previous step. That is, you can't have a local stock market without local stock. And you can't have a diversified investment fund unless you have a stock market where people can trade their shares that are liquid. And you can't have a mutual fund unless there are the first generation of local investment funds. So the way that I look at the problem now is that last year, when it was almost a year ago when President Obama signed in the Rose Garden the Jobs Act, which legalized crowdfunding, we made a huge change in securities law that I can explain the details around that, but soon will make it easier and cheaper for the 99% of us who are not rich to put money into local small business. So we've kind of gone to, you know, step one of this five-step process of building this financial ecosystem.
Yeah, and, you know, I was reading about now with the interest rates are so low and the banks, people, you know, looking at 0.01% to have their money in a savings account or some kind of interest-bearing account. So more people are looking for where they can put their funds in a way where they can make some money and also help out their community. So aren't there now groups of people who are kind of pooling their funds and investing together?
Up to a point. So the problem is that securities law is really a universe with three major acts. So one act in 1933 was around the issuance of stock. The next act in 1934 was on the trading of those securities. And the final act in 1940 was on investment companies. And investment companies is in some ways the most onerous, most restrictive kind of law out there. So it is exceedingly difficult for a group of so-called unaccredited investors. And again, to underscore, an accredited investor who's allowed to invest in anything is in the top 1% of income and wealth. Everyone else has to go through an elaborate and expensive, legally complicated process to put their money into any kind of local business. But for a local investment fund, basically, an unaccredited investor cannot participate in any local investment fund, except, and there are some like very specific exemptions within the Investment Company Act. So, for example, if you are a nonprofit, you can create, in some states, a revolving loan fund that supports small business with small loans, and that, if your state gives you permission, that could be open to unaccredited investors. So we have examples of funds like that in Western Massachusetts, in New Hampshire, in North Carolina. There's another one that I wrote about in Local Dollars, Local Cents in Columbus, Ohio. But there's really, I mean, you literally can count on one or two hands the number of funds around the United States that allow unaccredited investors to participate. So the way that people have done it,
Michael, I'm going to have to interrupt you there and hold that thought. We'll come back to you momentarily. We need to pause now for a break. This is Eleanor LeCain speaking with my guest, Michael Schumann, on All Together Now.
Let's give them something to talk about, babe.
Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain speaking with my guest, Michael Schumann, author of Local Dollars, Local Cents, How to Shift Your Money from Wall Street to Main Street and Achieve Real Prosperity. We're talking today about building resilient and prosperous communities. So, Michael, before the break, we were talking about how crowdfunding became legalized last year. Can you tell us a little more about what is crowdfunding and what was the political coalition that made it possible to pass that law?
So crowdfunding is referring to whenever a relatively large number of people put in relatively small amounts of money into a company. It comes in a bunch of flavors right now on the internet. So one kind of flavor is a site like Kickstarter or Indiegogo, where people can donate money effectively to businesses or projects, and that's entirely legal. Another flavor is where you do peer-to-peer lending. So a site like Kiva might allow you to do, say, a $100 loan to a micro-entrepreneur in, say, Bolivia. And because you don't get interest back on this, this is not regarded as a security. Kiva is pretty much accepted to be legal right now. There are some sites out there like Prosper and the Lending Club, which allow the crowd to actually get interest if they do peer lending. But those sites have had to do fairly expensive, literally millions of dollars worth of legal work to meet the securities laws requirements. But those now are open for unaccredited investors to put money into. What's going to happen, though, when the Jobs Act is completely implemented, which could be in less than a year from now, is that companies will be able to go to a new generation of websites, and these websites will be able to offer equity stakes in these companies. They will be able to offer royalty relationships where you get a percentage of the profits or a percentage of the revenues. Or they also may be able to enable the unaccredited investors to get involved in debt deals. So really what we're waiting for is that the SEC has been instructed by the law to promulgate regulations. They were supposed to have done their homework by last December. They failed to do so, and they're kind of dragging their feet. They're not really excited about this law because it's going to put a lot of securities lawyers out of business. But at the end of the day, they do have to implement it. And I think, you know, in something like 6 months to a year, there will be a proliferation of sites on the internet where unaccredited investors can participate in all kinds of small businesses.
Well, that's very exciting. So for our listeners here today who are learning about this, is there anything they can do right now, say if they have some money and they don't want it sitting in the Bank of America getting 0.01% interest? They want to put it somewhere where they're going to support a small local business or maybe invest in and possibly grow their money along with the company growing. Is there a way people can do that right now, or do we need to wait the 6 to 12 months?
There are a bunch of tools that you can do right now. And so, again, a couple of things that I mentioned already, like Kiva microlending, or putting money into Kickstarter and Indiegogo, those are totally legal for unaccredited investors. But here are other things you can do.
But those are, just to be clear, those are donations, right? Those aren't really investments.
Right. You're not going to make money on them.
Right. So if someone wants to invest, what would they do?
You could put your money in municipal bonds if you thought they were linked with a good project.
Mm-hmm.
You could put your money, some banks and credit unions that I wrote about actually have created special certificates of deposit that support targeted local business. So I'll give you an example. In your native Boston, Wainwright Bank, which since became Eastern, created these certificates of deposit linked with Equal Exchange, a fair trade company. And basically, you put your money into these fair trade CDs, and you know that your money is going to be used to support equal exchange. And the result is equal exchange now has $1 million line of credit out of Eastern Bank. And that could be done anywhere around the country. Another example is getting involved in co-ops. So many co-ops around the country borrow from their members and pay very well. So a co-op could be a really interesting investment, particularly if the co-op has been around for a while, say a grocery co-op that wants to do a capital expansion project. Usually those are pretty low risk because you know what the business is.
Mm-hmm.
Another kind of thing you might get involved with is pre-sales. I wrote about a coffee shop in Oakland, California, that needed $100,000 to move its store to another location. It needed $100,000, and it decided, rather than issuing securities that would have cost a lot of money from attorneys, they would pre-sell coffee. And the basic deal was buy $1,000 worth of coffee today, and you will get $1,200 worth of coffee when the new store opens up. There are some legal details around all of that, but broadly speaking, in most U.S. states, pre-selling, pre-purchasing is an entirely legal form of people supporting local business.
Wow, that's a great model. Go ahead.
Oh, go on. The last thing I was going to mention, and just I think this sort of ties together everything, mm-hmm. is that people don't appreciate that they have enormous power to invest locally through a self-directed IRA. So most of us have, you know, IRAs that are, you know, conventional, and we only can invest in stocks and bonds that are offered by mutual funds or other big financial institutions. But it is legally possible to roll over your normal vanilla-flavored IRA into a self-directed IRA. And a self-directed IRA basically allows you to hire a custodian for maybe $200 a year and direct that person to put your money into any of the things we just talked about. So you could put your, you know, tax-deferred money in targeted CDs. You could lend it to your co-op. You could put it into Prosper or Lending Club. You could invest it in local businesses when the crowdfunding laws come into effect. Really, the only thing you can't do with your self-directed IRA is invest in your own house or your own business, your kid's house or your kid's business. But interestingly, you can put money in your neighbor's house, and your neighbor can put their self-directed IRA into your house. So there's lots of interesting uses we've barely scratched the surface of potential of.
That's fascinating. And I think it's really exciting that this this new legislation makes possible these local stock exchanges. And so you're saying that's coming online in the next 6 to 12 months. So with all that you know about what's going on, what would you suggest to someone in terms of aligning with the principles that you've laid out in local dollars, local cents? You know, how would the person who's listening be able to align with the principles that you laid out so they can be investing in a way that supports the local small and medium business?
So here's what I think are three really simple steps that you as a community could take. I mean, I know some people will be listening strictly as individuals, and there are individual actions in here, but let's at least begin by talking about community kinds of steps. First thing is that a community could create just a listing on its public website of every local investment opportunity. It can't provide extensive details. It can't do any of the transactions. But just providing the list makes it clear that actually there are local investment opportunities in the area. So that's number one. And, you know, so we're talking about, for a typical community, an expansion of their website by a couple of $1,000s. Okay, that's all it's going to take. Number two, the city could basically put out an RFP to accountants and say, who is willing to do self-directed IRAs at a discount? And the idea being that if you got, say, 1,000 people to do a self-directed IRA, a custodian might lower the rate from a couple of $100 to, say, $100. So make it a really cheap available service in your community. And I am very confident that there are many, many accountants, many local financial institutions that would jump at the opportunity to provide that service. So just those two things, making people aware of what are the local investment opportunities and giving them the ability to use their tax-deferred IRA to put money into those opportunities, I think that's a home run in beginning to exploit all the potential for local investment in your community. The third thing is there's a company that I've worked a little bit with called Mission Markets, and Mission Markets has community portals, so basically virtual spaces where people will soon be able to do the purchase and the resale of securities in local small business, actually the beginnings of really local stock markets. And these are very inexpensive to deploy. And one can imagine that, you know, as hundreds and then thousands of communities have their own community portals, an entire new generation of local investors and local businesses will begin to find themselves, find one another.
Fantastic. So a lot of people will say, you know, on the one hand, it's very exciting that we get local businesses with these potential local stock markets coming up. But what about the concern about local businesses being fundamentally uncompetitive and with a high failure rate? I mean, we've all heard, 90% of companies fail within the first 5 years. So people might be nervous about investing in something like that. What do you say to that concern?
Well, I think the concern is very real. And the mistake that people make is assuming that you would only invest in a startup local business. But really, a smart local investor will put very little money into startups because all startups are risky. But the vast, vast majority of local businesses, and certainly the vast majority of local investment opportunities, will be in those companies that are well-established with good track records. And here's the thing. I mean, I actually feel in some ways conflicted about the new crowdfunding reforms, because a lot of what they permit, these reforms permit, is for small companies to pitch people living hundreds or thousands of miles away from where the company operates. And with that distance, I think there's a lot of opportunity for fraud and dishonesty. Mm-hmm. And so really, the piece of the crowdfunding universe that is going to be better, more honest, is going to be the local piece, because that's where you can literally go to the local business, you know, sniff around, touch the product, experience the service, talk with the workforce, kibitz with the manager, and then convince yourself that this is really a good investment opportunity. So it's that ground truthing, that reality checking, that I think is critical to make this new kind of universe of investing work.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I share that concern. I can see this could be rife with fraud. And while some of the securities laws definitely limit it, the ability to get good returns to the top 1% of the wealthy, at the same time, part of the intention is to protect people who can't afford to lose their investment funds. So, you know, we want to enter this with eyes wide open. So, Michael, since you know about all these local businesses and so forth, are you going to start some kind of investment fund that people could invest through you into what you think are the most likely to succeed companies?
Well, I frankly regard myself as a much better advocate than an investor. So I simply am on the side of trying to let people know about what tools are out there. I mean, I will say that I've gotten excited and begun to work a little bit with Mission Markets because I think that the next generation of work is these sort of local stock markets that provide liquidity. Mm-hmm. And I feel like they are one of the few players out there that is going to provide that kind of service that is affordable, that meets all the legal bells and whistles that are required of it. So, I am continuing to look at what are other interesting kind of cutting edge tools for local investment. I mean, I'll give you one example of something that really interests me. So I mentioned earlier that it appears that even though you can't invest your IRA in your own house, you can invest in your neighbor's house. Well, suppose you invest in a neighborhood investment association or property association, or maybe it's a neighborhood REIT, a real estate investment trust, or maybe it's a community land trust. Whatever it is, you may be able to invest indirectly in an institution that is providing the mortgage to your own house. And so on the one hand, you know, you're building up your wealth through the interest mortgage deduction, and you're building up your wealth by using your precious pension dollars to go into the single most important asset you will ever know in your life, namely your house.
Mm-hmm. Good. You know, listening to this and thinking how remarkable it is that this Jobs Act was passed that makes it possible to do all these new and interesting opportunities in local investing. And I'm curious, you know, you laid out at the beginning quite a number of changes that would need to be made and should be made in our laws and regulations. What do you see as the political coalition that made this Jobs Act possible?
Well, what it was were really three constituencies who were very odd bedfellows. So you had, you know, local economy, locavore kind of people like me. You had Tea Party Republicans who wanted to overhaul all kinds of regulations on the books. And you had high-tech young people with their iPhone apps who wanted greater ability to get crowdfunding-type investment into their innovations. And it really was, I think, all three working together that made the difference in moving this through Congress. And it's an interesting coalition because I think it's a coalition that can work for other kinds of reforms of business law as well down the road. And I should also say that this coalition really was quite pragmatic, and we did not work in a very public and visible way, and I think that helped as well, because if Wall Street really understood that this work was going to undermine their monopoly on long-term capital, they would have opposed this. And instead, they just kind of thought, oh, this is an interesting little experiment. We'll let it go ahead.
Interesting. So we're coming towards the end of our time together, and I know you have so much more to share with our listeners. Is there a website or someplace people can go to learn more about the work that you're doing?
Well, I'll give two website addresses. One is current, which is small-mart.org, and I'm about to develop another website that's going to go by the name of Locatopia, LOCATOPIA.net, and that will be up and running in a couple of months.
Fantastic. And, Michael, is there anything you'd like to share with our listeners that we haven't spoken about yet today?
Well, I would just say that if anyone is interested in getting a list of local investment tools, I do have a little document that I would be happy to share with people, and you can just email me at Schumann, S-H-U-M-A-N, at igc.org, and just mention that you heard this little offer to get the 20-plus investment tools, and I will send those to you, and hopefully some of them will resonate with things you can do.
Fantastic. Really appreciate that. So, listeners, if you want to get those tools, email Michael, and he will send them on to you. So thanks for that. And Michael, I know, you know, we started this talking about Boston and the importance of having strong communities. And I so appreciate all that you've done and continue to do to help make sure that communities are strong and that the small and mid-sized businesses have a chance to succeed even in a somewhat tilted playing field. But it looks like we've got some openings coming that make new possibilities there for investors and for businesses. So thanks for all your great work in this area.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being able to spend some time with you and share these ideas with your listeners.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Michael. And as the regular listeners know, this is Eleanor Lacaine, and I have a website with a focus on breakthrough solutions, looking for the best of what's working in America. And if you'd like some more information about those solutions in different areas, you can go to that website. It's www.thebreakthroughway.com. That's all the time we have for today. And Michael Schumann, thank you so much for coming on the program. And in case,
my pleasure.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Next week, you'll be joined by my co-host, Charlene Spretnik. I'll be back 2 weeks from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor Lacaine with All Together Now.